I'm ready.
You go, girl.
All right. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is piano player and filmmaker, Dean Mermel.
Howdy.
Dean Mermel is also the composer of the Comedy Death Star theme music. We'll meet Dean in a moment and meet his piano. But first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is a fan of pianos and film, Dean Mermel. Hello, Dean.
Hi.
It's really nice to be here. We're on the road this week, San Francisco. We're not in Hollywood. We're here at Dean's home studio in Bernal Heights.
Bernal Heights.
Well, this is the hill.
It's on the slope of the hill.
It's on the hill. Yeah. The Heights is on the hill.
Yeah.
And we're going to meet Dean's piano. Let's just start right there, Dean. Let's let the piano out of the bag.
Okay.
What do you got here? Tell us about this amazing, amazing machine.
Well, what this is a restored 1925 Mason and Hamlin Model A, which is a 5'8" grand piano.
Grand piano.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, I was going to say a player piano, but that's not accurate.
Well, it is accurate, but it doesn't tell the whole story.
Okay.
Because player pianos generally play at, they're generally the, when you hear the term player piano, you think of that saloon piano. Plays at one setting, which is basically loud.
Right.
All the time.
It's all the same. Blinka, 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 blinka.
Exactly. Yeah. What this piano is called a reproducing piano. And it's called that because it was designed to actually reproduce the dynamics of the performance that the musician that played it on brought to the piece of music. So when he played soft, or she played soft, the piano would reproduce it.
Right.
Okay. Just the same way. When they played loud or pianoforte, it would be equal in volume to that performance.
Got it. And so you have, how long has it been? 2 years that you've had this piano?
About a year and a half.
About a year and a half. And mm-hmm. when you found it, it was not working.
It was in not pretty upward. Deplorable condition. Yeah. But it would play roles, however, very, very haltingly. The piano itself had this horrible kind of lime avocado green finish somebody thought would look very attractive on it back in the 70s.
So it would match their refrigerator. So,
yeah, or their Studebaker, yeah. Or who knows what. I took it to a local shop here, DC Piano, who worked with me and really restored it to look gorgeous.
It's beautiful.
Mahogany, matte finish, restored all the key tops. Restrung the piano with a combination of German strings and Canadian bass strings and really brought their best game to this piano.
When you said Canadian bass, yeah. You know, of course, my mind heard Canadian
bass.
Bay, oh. And I wanted to say bacon, Canadian bacon. I thought the second yeah. syllable was going to be Canadian bacon.
As far as I know, there's no bacon involved
no
in the
bacon
restoration of this
involved
piano.
Involved in the restoration but of this piano.
It's entirely possible.
Well, it does. It looks fantastic. The wood looks beautiful. All the brass fittings and screws. I mean, I don't know if they're all new or they just cleaned them and polished them and
they
stuff.
They basically worked with like what was there. They basically restored what was there. The only they put in the new things that they added were things like the, for all you piano geeks out there, the tuning pins are blued steel, which mm-hmm. is a better option than what was there. So they replaced all the tuning pins. They replaced all the strings, as I said. They left the hammers, which I'm beginning to think the hammers might need to be replaced, but as it is, they were just sanded flat.
Yes.
And so that they could make a more even strike point on the strings. That's a common approach. And then the hammers were voiced, which means poking the hammers to right. soften them up a bit because that in time hammers get old. So this is, you know, this instrument's over 90 years old.
Yes.
And needed a lot of TLC, yeah. but it's come back very nicely.
And we've had this conversation about the hammers and that they're made out of felt and then mm-hmm. they get dense over time. And
yeah.
they, like you said, they sand them and then they poke them with pins to re-soften them to get them to the right texture. So when they hit the strings,
yeah.
it voices properly in the way that you want to do it. Well, yeah, exactly. 90 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember when you told me about it, you were super excited and
yeah.
it needed all this work and it looked horrible. And we're going to post some pictures online because underneath the thing yeah. that is the mechanism that makes it play the roles? I mean, there's a lot of information there.
It's a amazing, steampunk orgasm, basically.
Steampunk orgasm. It's an amazing monster underneath this piano. Right?
Yeah. Vacuum tubes. There's a big, fat electric motor. There's a big vacuum pump. The whole thing works off of vacuum. So there's lots and lots of little tubes. Most of those tubes have been replaced at this point. Everything gets routed to this little piece of brass that sits under the keyboard where the rolls get threaded onto it, called a tracker bar. And the tracker bar has all these little tiny holes in it. When the roll, the paper roll, passes over the tracker bar, the holes in the roll line up with the hole in the tracker bar and sucks air in. That is what triggers a little valve, a little mechanism that actually causes the whole Rube Goldberg series of events that causes the hammer to strike the string.
Right.
So each note has its
own. Instead of your finger hitting the key that pushes the arm that hits the string, it's this vacuum that triggers that whole
engages this whole series of mechanical events that results in a hammer striking the string and making that note with varying degrees of intensity.
Right.
It's really quite amazing technology.
And in 1920 or 1925, when this piano was made, this was state-of-the-art technology.
Yeah.
State-of-the-art. Can we hear a roll, first of all? Can we
just
hear something? I'll tell you what. I'm gonna go and pick out one of those rolls. Play a little. Let us hear the tone and the personality of this thing.
Yeah, all right.
What you can't see at home is that this is a grand piano.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it takes up most of your living room.
Yeah.
But, you know, you sacrificed your living room for
art. And in this living room, the whole house is basically furnished from things from either IKEA or the flea market.
Right.
And in the middle of all that is this giant, precious object.
Right. That you spent the past 18 months refurbishing.
And, yeah.
So I've picked, you have a bunch of rolls, some of which you got with the piano, some separately, or all of them?
No, they all came. With the piano, I got six big boxes of piano rolls, about 180 altogether.
And as we have mentioned, at the time, this was like somebody's CD collection.
Exactly.
Right? That what's super interesting to me about this technology is that before this technology, if you wanted to hear music, you had to go to a concert hall and hear a professional pianist, or you had to play it at home.
Yeah, or have someone come to your house and play. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And with this technology of the piano and the rolls, now you could reproduce. This is the first music reproduction technology in the world.
It could well be. I mean, there were wax recordings, but that wasn't a very practical thing to market.
Yeah.
So in the teens and 20s, these piano companies partnered with these companies that made the player mechanisms.
Sure.
There were three big ones. There was this one, which is Ampico, or some people call it Ampico, which is an acronym for American Piano Company. There is Welty, I believe it's pronounced, which I believe is a German company. And there is Duotone. I might be getting some of this screwed up. But different companies, like Steinway, use DuoArt. That was their company, and they made player units specifically for Steinway.
Right.
Mason and Hamlin and some of the other piano companies that weren't quite as big a name as Steinway but were still very good pianos, Ampico became pretty much the dominant company that that supplied these things. And the thing was that none of these roles aren't interchangeable between companies. So if you have an Ampico piano, it only really takes the Ampico rolls.
And so that's like VHS and Betamax.
Exactly.
Like you would have a movie and you can't use it on the other machine and so that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I am very interested. This is the beginning because obviously we're still dealing with this kind of issue now.
It's the beginning of format wars.
Format wars and how we have music and bring our music to us personally, so we don't have to go see Beyonce in concert. I mean, we can, but we can also listen to her stuff anytime we want. But this is where this conversation began.
This is where it began, and from here it went to radio, it went to 78 records, it went to
cassette tapes,
and then an CDs, iPod.
CDs, don't forget CDs. They happen for a minute.
iPods, yeah. So all this stuff, which largely was propelled by the American music industry. Even though it had ramifications all around the world almost instantly, and Japan certainly had a share in it because of Japan's mastering of all the technology involved. But it kind of began with these machines, these player pianos.
Reproduction of music at home. Personalization of your musical library and your... You could have a musical library in this way. Not be a musician, but just a consumer. So
And this was the first way people really consumed music.
And this is 100 years ago, and you know all these things were changing, right, technology-wise, 100 years ago. So that's part of what I find fascinating about this machine, is it's at the birth of something that has really changed our world.
Yeah.
You know, about this is not electronic music technology. It's mechanical.
Yeah.
But it began something that is mass production and mass distribution of music that is obviously still happening today.
And all bound up with a lot of other stuff that is intrinsically related, like the Industrial Revolution.
Sure.
Mass manufacturing, which, of course, impacted the economy, put people out of work because machines were suddenly doing things people were doing up to that point. Also, it's important to remember that when you hear the music played on a player piano, it's not coming through a speaker.
Right.
It's actually manipulating an actual instrument that people usually play and causing the music to come out of that same instrument as if a human being was playing it.
Right. So now, of course, we've skipped that step and we have recordings, but it's just what all of that goes into what makes this piano and this moment of time kind of a special, interesting thing.
And when you think about it, in so many ways, it's really superior to any recording technology, because if you have one of these in your house and it's in good shape, you are actually hearing the best reproduction of that music you could possibly hear, because it's actually not even a reproduction. It's actually happening right there in front
of you. It's production.
It's a production.
It's not a reproduction.
It's being produced right in front of you.
But there's a question. Is it it is in a way a reproduction of the original activity of the person who played it as it was recorded.
Right.
But it's not a reproduction of that recording in the same way we understand today. That's just all interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I've picked a roll here from your many rolls. And this one is, it was cost $2 at the time.
Yeah.
It is Arabesque number 2 by Debussy.
Good choice.
Yeah. Let's check that out.
Okay. The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to pull out this drawer, which is directly under the keyboard of the piano and has all these controls on it, things like the tempo. You set the tempo that, and when you open up, and it's got this place for two reels.
The listening folks at home, I'm going to take some photos of this as you're doing it, because this is a radio kind of program, so I can post the things and they can see what the heck you're talking
about. They'll see me in my pajamas.
Just go ahead.
Okay.
You're not going to be in it. It's all about the piano.
Yeah, I know.
We only need your voice and your expertise.
I'm fine with all that.
We don't need
your
legs.
And maybe what you should take a picture of, actually, is me holding this roll and kind of showing you the label. This is what you first see when you open up the roll. You see the tempo. You see it's Ampico or Ampico recording for use only on the Ampico. And you see the title of the piece, and more, very importantly, you see who played it. On all of these, it shows both the composer, the name of the piece, and the player. And the players of the time, in this case, it's this guy named E. Robert Schmitz, who I'm not that familiar with, but there are others that became like the rock stars of the time. And some of those guys were have incredible histories to tell.
Yeah, and I'm sure, and we've also chatted a little bit about it. If you're the piano company mm-hmm. and you want to sell these pianos, you have an interest in marketing these players, the yeah. people who made the roles, because they become stars and they're like pop stars, like anybody. You want the new Justin Bieber recording.
Yeah.
You want the new Rachmaninoff piano role or yeah. whatever. I mean, it's that, right? I mean, here's the new hit or the new thing by this person. And, you know, this is what you buy this week.
The beginning of the music industry.
Yeah, the beginning of the music industry. All right, Liz, so tell us what you're doing as you put the role on, and I'll take some photos that...
All right, so I've placed the role on the, I don't know what you call it, the feed, or there's two role positions. It's just like a projector. You have one reel that where you put the role as it's presented, and then you have like a take-up spool. And there's a little hook on the paper. And by the way, this has a very, very parchmenty feel. I mean, it's a piece of paper that's about 90 or 100 years old, and it's got a really nice feel to it. I really like opening these boxes and touching these things and smelling them. They are just really a link to the past that no longer exists. So it says tempo 105, so I'm going to go over here to the tempo control. And I'm going to adjust it to be 105. And there's nothing wrong with playing it slower or faster, but what ends up happening is the reason it says tempo 105 is because that will give you the truest representation of the tempo it was played at.
I understand.
So if you want to play it slower, you can. And my understanding is that a lot of people... who were learning how to play these pieces would use these roles as learning devices so they could slow them down.
And then kind of keep up.
Kind of get an idea of how it was played and then take it back up to tempo again. So I've just threaded it into place.
Yeah.
I'm moving the switch from rewind to play, which engages the transmission into forward. And now I'm going to turn it on and we're going to play this piece.
Okay. Thank you.
And now it's rewinding the roll. It reaches the end and automatically rewinds.
It's an amazing thing. Now, what you won't be able to see or hear is that as this thing was running, you know, I looked underneath. You know, I crawled under the piano to look at the underside, and there's, you know, a big belt and wheels and tubes going. Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's a steampunk orgasm thing going on underneath there.
It totally is.
Yeah.
It's totally amazing. And it's amazing to me that there are still some people that understand exactly how these things work. And I've seen schematics of the... I'm trying to get a hold of one for this particular machine. Incredible amount of complexity and layers of complexity as to how the air moves through this thing in order for it to happen, and right. How the vacuum systems connect with the mechanical systems. And the only electricity involved is only to turn the motor.
So there's like the motor turns and it does a pump and creates the vacuum, and then everything else happens.
Everything else works off the vacuum.
Off of this very physical, tangible system.
And before electricity was commonly in homes, this very, very similar version of this system used to happen with pedals, so that these pianos used to come with opposing pedals, just like a pump organ, and you would manually create the vacuum by pumping on these pedals, which is probably a lot of work.
But that would drive the same system, and you would physically pump it. Yeah, the guys who know how to do this and fix this stuff, they're getting kind of old, right? They're old and crusty.
Well, my first guy, really sweet man, Howard Goldberg, he's having some health issues now. He's older. He started the restoration on it, and he's not really able to come over and make it up the stairs and work on it anymore. He is an extremely knowledgeable man about this stuff. So I have another person now, Rick Bourgeois, who's also very well regarded here, but there's not a lot of these guys around.
Well, the technology is 100 years old. So, you know, anybody that knew how to do it, right? They don't keep making people that know how to do this stuff.
Well, and I actually asked Howard at one point, I said, do you have an apprentice? Do you have anybody that you're teaching this stuff to? And he basically said, nah, nobody's talking to me. There's nobody that's like carrying this on. And of course, it makes me feel like, well, okay, is this the course I want my life to take? Do I want to learn how to do this stuff? And the answer is no. I kind of have other. I've got other stuff going on.
Years and years of your life to this stuff, and then
kind of
other people's pianos, and you know, it's
It's a very geeky profession.
Yeah,
but surprisingly, there are internet forums and user groups for this stuff, and people share lots of information, and there is a whole community of people around the world that that are into this stuff. And recently, I should mention that Stanford last year came into a huge collection of what's called mechanical instruments. You know, this is one kind of mechanical instrument. They also have things that play like music box. A music box is another kind of mechanical instrument. They also have player pianos and reproducing pianos that don't even have a keyboard. They're made specifically just to play rolls. So Stanford recently came into a huge collection, private collection, of these kinds of instruments and the rolls that they play.
And they're going to, whatever universities do, hold on to them and keep the technology alive. And
Hopefully they'll do a good job of archiving all this stuff and making it available for people to listen. I know they've already had at least one concert.
So anybody out there in our listening audience somewhere around the world, if you have an interest in apprenticing to learn how to restore, refurbish, and reimagine reproducing pianos, you know, the world needs you.
Yeah.
And you should just step right up. Now, what did we listen to again, the role?
Debussy. This piece was a piece by Debussy. It was Debussy's Arabesque number 2.
Yeah. And we mentioned earlier... the roles are generally like 2 to 5, 2 to 6 minutes. I mean, it's not unlimited length of time that you can
make a roll. It's a piece of paper.
It's a piece of paper that has to fit in a certain size and shape.
There are, I mean, definitely some of the roles are fatter than others. This one's medium. And as I said, if you play it faster, it won't last as long.
Right. But there's a limitation to the format itself.
The physical
format.
Like
an LP. Exactly. You know, it was like 45 minutes each side. You couldn't get 3 hours of music on an LP, record.
And one thing that's kind of common, like I have this other role here I'm holding, which is Musical Comedy Favorites, number 9. And this has, there's 6 pieces of music on here played by Adam Carroll, who is one of the best known, if not the best known, Ampico recording artists. And he basically plays like a verse and a chorus from several different musical comedies.
A little medley.
At the time. So it's medleys.
Things that were popular of the day.
Medleys were very popular.
Right. Mm-hmm. A little mashup.
Yep.
Well, tell us, so we've been talking about this amazing technology and how it began at this point in time, and a whole industry has come out of that. When this technology was at its height of perfection, mm-hmm. what happened?
The Depression. The Depression hit. Mm-hmm. And such frivolities were not people's priority unless you had so much money that you were untouched by the events happening around you in 1929.
So in 1929, we had an economic change that changed this thing. But then you also mentioned that there were some other forces that killed this technology, basically.
It overlapped with radio.
Radio.
And also 78 records. Mm-hmm. I mean, the gramophone had already kind of existed, but it was just as rarefied a thing as this. Of course, this is a piano, and it cost, you know, in the day that this piano was made in 1925, with the player unit, it could have cost $4,000, maybe $5,000, no more than that. But $4,000 or $5,000 in 1925 was a lot of money.
A lot of money.
So aside from the
economic change of the 1929 stock market crash, mm-hmm. depression in the 30s, radio happened.
Yeah.
Right? And if this is a way to bring music to a mass audience, and it's a distribution method, basically, mm-hmm. Radio killed the player piano star.
Exactly. Exactly.
To paraphrase a much later later pop song.
Yeah. But just as accurate, you know, time progress marches on.
Right.
And the birth of the consumer, actually, you know, the music consumer started happening when records became available. This was really the birth of the music consumer, but you had to have a piano in your house. Now, having said that, in the 20s, regular pianos were relatively inexpensive. Even though there was like this big, major crafted thing, there were so many piano manufacturers in America in the 20s. There's a figure that we bat around sometimes, my friend and I, it's unknown exactly, but there was approximately 500 piano manufacturers just in the city of New York.
Different companies. And you said small businesses, mom and pop piano makers in their garages.
Literally making them in their garage.
Right.
They would get parts. The parts started getting more standardized, both in America and also in Germany. And a lot of the immigrants came from Germany who made pianos. They were already making them there. So they used their know-how. They moved to America, and using parts from both Germany and America, they put it together with their own special secret sauce, their own case design. So many variables in a piano. So many patents also. When you open up any piano, the first thing that that'll catch your eye is all these different dates that are like highlighted on the metalwork. And the first impulse is, oh, it says 1910. This piano was made in 1910. But if you actually read the whole thing, you see it's patent 1910. So that idea for how that particular part was made was patented in 1910. There's so many precedents for the Industrial Revolution that you can see when you look inside a piano.
And I get it that not everybody had a piano. On the other hand, mm-hmm. they weren't spending money on cars,
right.
televisions, refrigerators, mm-hmm. you know, dishwashers. I mean, you know, this is the thing that was starting to happen at that time,
yeah.
right? Machines that could do things that could be sold to the masses, mass-produced, and like an average American home could have something. Yeah. But having a piano was not a big deal. A lot of people played.
It was as common as having a computer in your home.
Yeah. What do you do in the evening when you sit around? You could read. You could knit. You could play the piano.
Yeah. Or throw on a roll. If you had one of these fancy things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can we hear a little bit of? What that was the Debussy.
That was Debussy.
I had a Chopin here too.
What did I do with the show?
They're next to the cat. Chopin's Nocturne. That's a beautiful piece. Yeah. Yeah. This is played by Leo Ornstein. Copyright 1916 by the Ampico Company.
And it's a Nocturne, is that what it's said?
It's a Nocturne. Here's another interesting thing about these roles. You might want to get a picture of this.
Yeah, maybe.
A lot of these came with a little story. So it says here, the story of this piece. This nocturne is full of details of ravishing beauty. I love how they write these. A delicious warmth of color gives it almost an oriental atmosphere. Painting, as one writer says, the palm and the cypress, the rose thicket, and the great stars burning low in the southern sky, etc., etc. It's very, very flowery language.
Well, it's marketing language.
It's marketing language. Reveals the true Chopin writing from his heart and not for salon display. Yeah, it's totally...
This is what the 20th century brought us, was mass marketing. Right?
Yeah, so you buy
newspapers,
this,
radio,
you buy
television.
This thing for $2 and yeah. you get Chopin's Nocturne, Opus 15, number 2, played by Leo Ornstein.
Okay, so Ornstein. Let's hear a little bit of this.
Let's hear what Leo can do. I'm sure Leo was, no slouch. It's threading it onto the spool.
Right.
Getting it going, checking the tempo, which is 70, quite a bit slower than the last piece. Engaging the transmission to play and hitting on. Thank you.
As a novice piano player myself, I might not even qualify as that. It's really amazing to watch the keys get triggered without hands on them.
Yeah.
Just to see, like, how much range is being covered on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And, you know, at where the combination of notes.
Yeah.
And how that goes down is really kind of cool to watch that.
And as we were talking earlier, before we started recording this, there's a lot of... there's a whole thing about these roles, which is that they can actually be edited. And
right.
So many, there's a lot of controversy about, say, some Gershwin roles or some Rachmaninoff roles, where they were doing some things that, you know, really technically you would have had to have 12 fingers to do and a huge hand.
Which Rachmaninoff
which
had.
Which Rachmaninoff did have.
But not that good.
Possibly not quite that big. Although Rachmaninoff probably wanted to keep things legit. He was pretty adamant about it. And by the way, some of the roles I have are played by Rachmaninoff. So I'm sure he did not approve of people futzing with his performances. But as we were saying, there's a whole other subject, of course, but that Gershwin got his start in the music business by actually... producing these roles and working on editing them. So as a young man, he left high school at about 15 and went to work in a piano roll company.
Gershwin did. Yeah.
And so he was editing these roles for other players. Sometimes a player would make a mistake while playing it on the machine that actually recorded the role. So he could go in there and not only fix that, he could actually embellish it. And this was very common practice in those days.
So this is like the first version of what we have auto-tune now, that singers singers who aren't, you know, always perfectly on pitch necessarily.
More like manual tune, but yeah.
But, you know, like they as they sing, the engineers can also fix their voices and help them sound better. And this is the same thing. It's supposed to be a reproducing piano to reproduce a performance, yet...
Right.
As it was recorded, then a technician or musician would go back and edit, clean up the perforated rolls
exactly
to augment or fix anything that needed to be fixed.
Yeah, so they would have a master roll that they could plug one of the tiny holes with a little piece of tape or something so it wouldn't play. If somebody hit a B flat instead of a B, they could plug that B flat hole and right next to it punch a hole for a B. And then once they had that master roll done, they would make the subsequent copies from that corrected master roll.
And we talked about as it gets perforated, you have these hanging chads.
Yeah, hanging
like
chads.
Election.
That would be a thing. That would probably be one of the first things that needed to be done after a performance is clean that up.
Clean up the hanging chads. Well, we know what that. Could we change the subject to just like to launch off into something else? You have been working on something recently called Flower Piano. Tell us anything about Flower Piano.
Well, Flower Piano is a specific project that my friend Mauro Fortissimo and I put together. We are a small piano arts kind of organization called Sunset Piano.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunset Piano is in the business of, if you can call it a business, putting pianos out under the open sky for anybody to play. So we've been doing that. We did that on the coast in Half Moon Bay in San Mateo. We were asked to come to the city, and we've been doing that in UM Plaza.
This is San Francisco.
In San Francisco and the Exploratorium. We're doing it all over Market Street. And
when you were at Half Moon Bay, I mean, Mauro has a thing where he goes out onto the cliffs and plays piano for the whales.
Yeah, we're actually doing that later today.
And they respond.
We have had an amazing experience with that. And if you watch my upcoming film, 12 Pianos.
No, you can plug things here. That's partly what the show is. We're not paying you, so you get to plug whatever you want. What the film is called?
The film is called 12 Pianos. You can see a teaser trailer for it at 12pianos.com.
And it's a documentary.
It's a documentary about the Sunset Piano Project.
Okay.
And we actually have, I don't want to reveal too much about this, but yes, we do play for whales.
And they respond.
They have responded.
Have you done the thing, or you just told me where you're putting the pianos on a boat and taking them out into the ocean and playing for whales?
You'll have to see the film, but you will not be disappointed.
Will not be disappointed.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Flower Piano is actually a project that came from when we approached Golden Gate Park to put pianos in the park. And I actually had this idea since people in Europe and Seattle and Portland and all these different cities were putting pianos out in their parks. And I thought, well, we're a world-class city, and we're in the business of putting pianos outside. We should have it here. So I went to Reckon Park, and I proposed the idea for forest piano, mm-hmm. which was to put pianos in, you know, secret them and have people discover them in the forest at Golden Gate Park.
And the idea would be that if you were just walking by and you see a piano,
yeah.
you could just sit down and play. Anybody can do that. Okay,
that was the original idea. They call me back a couple days later, and they said, hey, we've got this great idea. The Botanical Garden here in San Francisco in Golden Gate Park is having its 75th anniversary. They would like to host the pianos. They were wonderful people and still are wonderful people to work with. And this was last year in 2015, and we put the pianos in there, and we also programmed the pianos, too, with many incredible musicians that we know. So for the weekends, for certain hours on the weekends, we had pianos programmed where they were being played by musicians that we love and respect here locally. And for the rest of the time, anybody could play a piano. People were lining up, little children lining up, holding their sheet music in their arms, lining up at a piano by this pond filled with geese.
On a Saturday morning.
On a Saturday morning.
Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, incredible scenes. You can see more about this if you go to our website, sunsetpiano.com.
Sunsetpiano.com, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's a page there for flower piano. And we just did our second annual flower piano. Just finished it this month.
Same place at the conservatory.
Not the conservatory, but the botanical garden. The conservatory is actually this big white building that's very humid inside, not conducive to pianos. The botanical garden is 55 acres of beautiful planted gardens. And we had a whole orchestra there this year and a piano concerto. It's off the hook.
It's a stunning location.
Yeah.
The conservatory. I mean, I keep saying the conservatory. Botanical garden. I know there is a difference. I've been to both of them. But the botanical garden in San Francisco in Golden Gate Park is a beautiful setting.
Totally.
It's all these hills, and it's got different flora from different parts of the world and different places. And as you wander through in different spots, there are pianos. Yeah. Some are under a tree. One is on a redwood deck. Mm-hmm. And people are... I was out there, and people just wander by and or hang out. And bring a picnic and, you know.
Piano party.
Things are happening. And how many were out there? 10, 12?
12.
12.
12. We try to always, whenever we do these large events, we've kind of settled on the number 12. We're not sure exactly why. It's a 12-tone scale. And 12 just seems like a good number.
12 bowling pins on the bowling alley.
As everybody knows.
Oh, no, it's 10.
Yeah.
All right, I'm wrong.
Oh, let's go with 12.
That's all right.
They won't know.
Nobody pays attention to bowling anymore.
Yeah.
I did see the event. I was there. Mm-hmm. So it was a weekend, a week, and a weekend.
It was 12 days total.
12 days. So, 12 keys, yeah. 12 pianos, 12 days.
12 is our magic number. Don't ask me why. I have no idea why. Mauro and I just kind of like settled on 12.
Well, that's what it is now, so it doesn't matter why.
That's what it is. So it starts kind of midweek. It starts on like a Thursday, and it encompasses two weekends and about a week and a half of weekday.
And the Botanical Garden people, they love it.
They totally love it.
It brings in more people to the Botanical Garden than they've ever had. People discover the gardens that they didn't, you know.
Record
didn't
attendance.
Know, didn't in, know it
for
was
75
there.
Years, yeah. record attendance. Yeah. And we're already in meetings for next year.
Right. And so it would be great to bring this to some other places we've talked about. Yeah. Boston or Atlanta.
I'd love to bring it to L.A. I'd love to bring it to Central Park.
Right. Right.
Yeah. That's a really great thing. We're going to work on that.
Yeah. Well, and today, you know, so much of our life is electronic and reproduced and all the stuff we've been saying. So when you can have a big thing like this that is very physical and then people are actually sitting down and playing for other people.
Yeah.
Outdoors. It is a unique experience, I think.
We call it the world's first interactive music festival.
The world's first interactive music festival.
Yeah, because it's interactive. There's kind of no, except on the weekends when we do have these stunning performers play, there's no real division between, there's no stage, there's no audience. It's a bunch of people standing around a piano, generally speaking. And there's something, you know, a piano, this is big, heavy thing. It's like a little planet. It kind of has its own gravity. You know, and you take this thing that's normally in a living room and you put it out in the in the California native garden, or, you know, or the, proteas or the rhododendron dell or whatever it is. And all of a sudden it's got this new context and people want to crowd around it. And then somebody sits down and plays some Chopin or some Rachmaninoff or some boogie woogie and, or some ragtime or some Thelonious Monk. And all of a sudden there's some magic there. And I love that. It takes away the concept of the stage and the audience. It's just people standing around a piano.
And somebody could be some professional person at some level playing Thelonious Monk, and they get up, and the next person that sits down is a beginner who once I heard a kid.
Who's doing. You get a lot of that.
And there, but that's also deeply gratifying.
Totally.
The audience is enjoying it. And, you know, and that person's eventually going to get up after 10 minutes. And
hopefully after 2 minutes.
Well, but and then you don't know who else is going to sit down. That's part of the fun.
That's part of the fun. Exactly. And then some schlubby guy that you would not want asking your daughter out sits down at the piano and all of a sudden busts out Rhapsody in Blue. And you're like, oh, my God, I really can't judge people.
Or a 12-year-old kid.
Or a 12-year-old kid who's like being frivolous and maybe whining to her mom 1 minute and sits down and then is playing Chopin. It's really unbelievable. And the thing that the really gratifying thing about flower piano is to see how personal music is for everybody. Everybody has a very personal connection with music, whether it's playing it or listening to it. And when you see people playing out there, you look at their face, you look at the expression of their face, people instantly go into this zone when they're playing, no matter what their musical ability, where they are getting in touch with something in themselves that is uniquely human. And it's really fun to watch that process take place.
So the website for that is Flower Piano?
Sunset Piano.
Sunsetpiano.com. And that tells us about Sunset Piano and Flower Piano.
Yeah, there's a whole page on Flower Piano within that, which is kind of our premier event. Right. We do several events, but Flower Piano is the biggie so far.
And then you also shot and edited a documentary.
Yeah.
About Sunset or about Flower Piano?
About the Sunset Piano project.
Okay.
It's kind of centered around the central character of my friend Mauro, who actually started this whole thing by bringing a piano out on the beach several years ago. And it became, he was just an art thing he wanted to do. So he took this old piano that somebody donated to him, wasn't a very good piano anymore, been in their family for a long time. What would be a fitting end for this beautiful family heirloom? So Mara said, well, I'll just take it. He lived right next to the beach in Half Moon Bay. He said, I'll just get some friends and we'll drag it out there and I'll just play for Sunset. And he did that every night for 2 weeks. After a few days of doing it and people snapping a lot of photos and posting them on YouTube and stuff like that, it went crazy. And all of a sudden, TV stations were coming down there with their trucks. It was turned into this, it went from being this little intimate performance thing to being this kind of internet meme. What was an unintended consequence of Sunset Piano, I think it was kind of unintended, is that the incredible amount of community building that has happened around it. Yeah. And it's a beautiful, harmless, good-feeling thing that the world just desperately needs more of.
Yeah. The other question I have about this is, when you guys are not doing this thing, what do you do with these? How many pianos do you have? If you have 12 out, you probably have 15 plus.
We've got about 12 in the city, and Mauro has a warehouse in Half Moon Bay that has at least 25 right now in various conditions.
Is that 40 pianos altogether?
We may have as many as 50 pianos.
As many as 50. And but they're not all in one place. They're kind of distributed around.
They're distributed between a couple places.
You guys are constantly loading and unloading, or you have, you know, big burly dudes.
We have big burly people that do that work for us now, because we're both old creaky men.
Well, and you play, I'd rather you play the piano than move a piano.
Well, we've come to that conclusion ourselves.
Yeah. but you got 50 pianos that you're constantly moving around and people give you pianos and
people do. I've got an email right now of someone I'm dealing with who wants to give us a grand piano. It looks like it's in good shape. there's a kind of a vetting process for each piano, because sometimes people just have an old junky piano they want to get rid of, and it's not an easy thing to move and get rid of.
Right.
So
that's why they want to give it to you.
So they want to give it to us, and we say, you know, we actually play these things, and they need to be in pretty good shape.
Right.
So we take on pianos that often need some work, not much though. Usually they've got to be in good shape. You know, we don't mind them being ugly and scratched up, because we don't treat them that nicely, to be honest. And the pianos, you know, these pianos are kind of in this in-between zone. A lot of them have been rented out for many years. They're not in great shape. They probably should be rebuilt, but they're not precious enough pianos or good enough name brands to warrant putting thousands of dollars into them to rebuild them. So they kind of fall through the cracks. We inherit those pianos. They're perfectly good.
I'm sorry, it's got to be a really big crack for
it's
a piano
a crack.
To fall
yeah.
through. I just
it's
had to
a,
say
it's
that.
A crack
the visual
that
I got
an 800-pound piece of stuff can go
let
through.
Let me see the crack that this piano is going to fall through. Yeah, go ahead.
And you know, they're headed downhill. They're not the best instrument. These are not concert-level Steinways. They're certainly not as good as this piano.
So now I'm getting an image of like Boulevard of Broken Pianos.
Yeah, that's nice.
Or
I
like
that
the dog and cat that we got this piano from the pound and it was kind of scratched up and we.
That's
you know,
a great analogy.
We're kind of partly refurbishing it and it's going to live out the rest of its life being more appreciated.
We're
than
like
ignored.
Mama Charity's home for wayward pianos. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're kind of a halfway house for pianos.
So these are you get pianos from the wrong side of the tracks,
and we clean them
and
up.
You clean them up and you kind of rehabilitate them. You give them some warm meals and.
Exactly.
New shoes and you know, and they at least end their days in a way that is useful and appreciated and reconnected.
Giving more joy than maybe they haven't for the 60, 70, 80 years of their existence.
Because they could just slowly sink into oblivion in somebody's garage.
Or and many of them
somebody's spare room and never be played again.
One of the best pianos we have was actually given to me by my neighbor, Mary, about five doors down from me. And she heard about our project last year just as we were getting ready to put the pianos out in the park. And she said, hey, you know, I've got this little grand piano. It was my mother's. I have kind of some emotional problems with my mom. I never play it. And every time I walk past it, I kind of trigger something in me. I think it would do you guys a lot more good than it would me.
So instead of an albatross around her neck, she's got a piano. I mean, she looks at the piano. She thinks of her difficult mom. She feels guilty.
And she could use the space.
And she can.
that's another thing.
Have I got a piano for you, boys?
So I walked down there and I checked it out. It was a very nice little piano. And we liked everything about it. And we had the movers who were picking up our other pianos pick up this one on the way to the park. And it has become one of our best pianos, the one that we have all our featured performances on. This piano turned out to be the right one for several technical reasons to do that. So instead of languishing away in this room, and it's not looking really good right now. You know, the finish is like half faded from the sun because it was left with the lid open. So the part that was exposed to the sun got all faded. The other part still looks good. It's an ugly duckling, but it's a wonderful piano. So that kind of describes some of the state of the pianos we get.
And I'm getting the idea that many of these pianos have personal stories, or the owners have stories about them because they're old. They don't move easily. People have had them for a long time.
Yeah.
It was my mother's, it was my kids, whatever. They have a personal story. So when they can get it back out into service, it feels good to them. It helps them rehabilitate their relationship with the piano and its own history and their own history by getting it out into the park or in somebody else's hands to play it again.
That's exactly right. I've heard many stories like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, I don't like to use the word karma too freely, but it's kind of like cleans up the karma around a piano or
it's
something.
Bad luck to use the word karma.
You don't want to,
you don't want to toss it around.
Yeah, dangerous. Yeah.
Okay, here's thanks for the flower piano, and check out the website and the information, and if you're interested in pianos, this is a really cool thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to change things up. We're almost out of time. Does it say on the recorder how much time we've been recording?
Yeah, it's 57 minutes and 10 seconds.
57 minutes and 10 seconds. That means we have to go pretty quickly. Okay. One of the things I like to do on this show is to anagram.
Yeah.
Because I think it's interesting to put your name in or something about you and see what pops out the other side, and it may be illuminating. I tried Dean Mermel.
Yeah.
I didn't
good
get
luck
a lot.
With that.
No, I didn't get a lot from that.
Yeah.
I was going to put Dean Mermelstein, which is rumored to be the original name that your family had.
I came from a line of Mermelsteins. Yeah.
Steinstein, you know.
It's true.
Whatever. I didn't do that, but I put in Dinoism because that is your blog.
Yeah.
Your blog and your writing spot.
Yeah.
And here are some things that came out. You see at the bottom of this page. I don't know if any of them are interesting to you.
Well, let's just see. yeah, these are great.
What are you laughing at? What's resonating?
Mad noise is good. Damn noise is good.
Yeah, mad dinoism. Damn noise.
A snide ohm. I like a snide ohm.
I thought you would like that.
Yeah. He's a demon.
Dinoism is a demon. Yeah.
Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, I like these. Adios, men. Great. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah, so
I'll cherish this always.
So, again, which one, if you had to pick one or two that pop for you the most or that, you know, interesting?
I like Is a Demon. I don't know why, but I like to get dressed up like the devil for Halloween, so maybe Is a Demon is good.
Dinoism is a demon.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I mean, that's how the thing works.
Kind of has a rhythmic thing to it, I like.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
But a snide ohm, I did like the implications there.
I'll use that as my writing nom de plume.
Nom de plume.
Yeah. Cool.
That's funny. Now, when you said nom de plume, I saw like a garden gnome with a plumed hat with a feather coming out of his head.
Well, you've clearly taken the right acid.
I'd never had that thought before.
Yeah.
A gnome de plume. Like a Harry Potter gnome with a...
Gnome de plume. Yeah,
you know what I'm talking
about. A gnome de plume.
They have that kind of Tyrolean, those hats with the feathers popping out.
Yeah, yeah.
That's interesting. What else do I want to ask you about? Oh, this is a question that I ask everybody on the show, and I do actually want to ask you two questions.
Mm-hmm.
One, as a child, you had an imaginary friend.
Oh, yeah.
What can you tell me about your imaginary friend?
Did I tell you about this?
I don't know. I'm asking. But the audience certainly hasn't heard.
Interesting. Well, strangely enough, his name was Mickey.
This is not a story I'm familiar with. We've been friends for a long time, now 20 years. Yeah.
Oh, I thought I told somebody recently. Mickey was my imaginary friend. I'm sure it came from Mickey Mouse because I liked Mickey Mouse. My mother recently gave me my first pajamas, which have Mickey Mouse on them. So I must.
Your mother still has your first pajamas?
She gave me my first pajamas.
So we're talking like 55 years, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
You're 60 now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was pretty crazy. I'll show you. She said these are the things they put, the first clothing I ever wore when I got back from the hospital. She put these pajamas on me, and they have Mickey Mouse on them.
Wow.
So my imaginary friend was named Mickey. I'm not sure if I thought of him as Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, what kind of creature was he?
It was pretty ethereal. It was kind of like my invisible friend.
Okay.
I didn't really have a visual concept of him. It was more like a presence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of little kids might actually have that.
Yeah.
There might be, you know, there's theories that there's like spirits hanging around little kids or something like that. And I think I had one of those.
Well, you were also an only child.
Yeah.
And your parents are pretty religious.
Yeah.
And so you had limited contact at times with the non-religious outside world. And
yeah, so they kept me pretty sheltered.
It would make sense you had it. So my normal question is to say, as a child, you had an imaginary friend.
Mm.
Your imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend.
That traitor.
Where are they now?
The imaginary friend's imaginary friend?
Exactly. Are they still in contact with Mickey? That's one question. And then, if so, what kind of relationship do they have now?
I would like to think they have reunions. But since I don't go to any of my reunions, it's unrealistic for me to expect that.
That your imaginary friends would go to theirs.
Would get together and talk about, old times. I would hope that they're out being benefactors for other aspiring, other kids that have a destiny that could be creative or world-changing in some way. I would hope that they carefully select their next human friend
And, like a guardian angel.
Like a guardian angel kind of thing, if such things actually exist. Well,
we don't need to know the answer to that question.
We don't need
for the purposes of this program, we don't need to know. Yeah. Did you get, but he feels like a, what did he give you? A creative support? Or, I mean, what was Mickey? Was he just a friend? Or did you get something that from him that you still carry on?
Somebody that I definitely could talk to, an ear, someone to bounce something off of. Because, yeah, I was very much an only child and very sheltered, so I didn't have a lot of people to talk to. My parents were aliens from another universe named the Ukraine and Yugoslavia. And they, as much as I love them, they were not people I could really talk to about the things going on for me as a young, confused child.
Yeah, and your dad was a rabbi. And so,
kind of, yeah, yeah, sort of a rabbi, yeah, of a religious figure.
Religious figure. Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Yeah. Now, here's my other question. You know, I have this thing about being hit in the face with a pie.
I do.
You do. Mm-hmm. My question for you, have you ever been hit in the face with a pie?
Yes.
By whom? It wasn't me.
No, it wasn't.
Was it recently?
No, it wasn't recent.
Okay.
It was a long time ago.
Okay.
I can't remember the details exactly. It was at a party.
I was going to say it was all very fuzzy.
Many people were grabbing pies and hitting each other in the face with pies.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So here's my question. Mm-hmm. You are going to be hit in the face with a pie in the future.
Clearly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you can pick any person in history to throw that pie and hit you in the face.
So someone to hit me? Who do I want to hit me in the face with a pie?
You can be hit in the face with a pie thrown by any person, living, dead, even imaginary. And I'm curious for you, who would you like to hit, but who would you like to have hit you?
To make my life complete?
Yeah, to make your life a bucket list. Who's going to hit you in the face with a pie?
I think I'm going to go with Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, the visuals I'm getting today are really good. Yeah, what would you imagine would happen there?
Well, I think we'd both just have a really great laugh about it. I'm sure he'd enjoy it. But he's so shy. He was so shy. I think it would take a lot for him to do that. So I would have had – the reason I like that is because I would have had to have already cultivated a really good friendship with him for him to do that, because it's not a thing that would occur to him to do naturally. Unless we were like really having a good time and goofing around. So I would like to have been close enough to Jimi Hendrix in our lives that he could have hit me in the face with a pie.
Well, that is indeed part of this. You know, most of the time when people get hit with pies, there's some aggression and some surprise, you know, and so it comes at, it's either protest or Three Stooges kind of something, but no one ever asks for it and, you know, is ready to accept it with love.
It's a great question.
But this is what we're talking about. You're going to accept this pie with love and an open heart from somebody that you have a connection, you know. And so, yeah, Jimi Hendrix for you.
Yeah, because for me, he was so much a part of my personal mythology growing up, because even though I have all this piano and all this classical music and stuff, I'm on my own. I'm basically a rock musician. That's my default, and I've always loved rock music. And for me, Jimi Hendrix was a huge world-changing experience. So, yeah, I think I have to go with Hendrix. Second, maybe Dylan. Either one of those guys would be fine.
Either one of those guys would be fine. You know, maybe they can, in between, like, do a duet of All Along the Watchtower, and then the other one could hit you in the face with the pie. And,
yeah, that would be like, just about perfect.
A pre and a post kind of thing, and they would
stereo.
Do it together in between. Yeah,
yeah, I think that...
Did they ever do that song together?
No.
On purpose or by accident, or just never happened? I mean, somebody must have asked that question aside from me, because they... It's a famous song for both of them.
I'm
for
sure they met, but I haven't read anything about that. Oh. Yeah, I mean, Dylan famously said that Jimmy did it better than him.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, anybody who is remotely interested in electric guitar can listen to that song and pretty much say, okay, that's how it's done.
That's the thing. But even the Dylan version is phenomenal.
Totally.
But the Jimi Hendrix version just...
It's
blows
kind of,
everything
kind of sublime.
Blows everybody away for like the rest of time, pretty much.
Yeah, I'm still blown away.
The last thing I wanted to mention, I just want to give a plug for the other part of your life. I mean, well, there's two other parts. First, you have all these films, silent films you've made, and other films that you've made. Mm. Where can people see any of those or find out more information about those, you have your own website, or is it
Dinoism? I have my own website, which is Story Farm.
Story Farm.
But it's not storyfarm.com, it's storyfarm.tv.
.tv. Well, that's like this program is acsdigital.tv.
Right.
That's how you can listen to this podcast.
You know what the interesting thing about the TV URL is that it's not, people commonly think it's television, but it's actually for the country of Tuva.
Yeah, which is in like, China somewhere.
Yeah, way out there someplace.
Well, that's where Richard Feynman went. Do you know that guy, the physicist, Richard Feynman?
Yeah.
Feynman, and he had that whole movie about him and his books, and he had the Tuvan throat singers, so all that kind of stuff.
But exactly.
We use it for TV. Anyway, storyfarm.tv
Correct.
Is where we can see some of your work. And the last part that I wanted to promote for you is that you and our friend Stephanos Xanthoudakis... I say his last name because I'm one of the few people that knows how to actually
damn good
pronounce it. It's a long Greek name that begins with an X.
Yeah.
But you guys have a Tom Jones cover a tribute band.
Well, it started out as a Tom Jones tribute band, and we did that for about 9 years, and that was with horns and backup singers and go-go dancers, and it was like a 10-piece band. It was a monstrous, ungainly thing.
And you do the arrangements and keyboard and organize the band, and Stephanos is Tom Jones. He sings.
Yeah. Now it's evolved. Now the band went away, as bands will. People got involved in their lives.
And you just got sick of some of them.
Well...
I'm teasing.
Yeah. No, it just became this very difficult thing to rehearse, and people's schedules were just crazy, and I was kind of the default manager, and I didn't like being put in that situation without any help. So I said, look, no one's going to help me. Let's just let this thing go, which we did. And now Stephanos and I are still Tom Jonesing, but it's just me on piano and him singing. And I sing a little bit too. And as it happens, we hardly do any Tom Jones songs anymore. But the name is so cool that we decided to keep it.
Tom Jonesing.
Tom Jonesing.
And where, if we wanted to look that up,
TomJonesing.com.
TomJonesing.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are on all the social media things. And
all that stuff.
Blah, 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 blah. Dean Mermell, M-E-R-M-E-L-L.
That's me.
All right. You could find Dean. He's out there. And if you do find him, you would like him. I mean, I like him. And I assume that if you're listening to the show that you at least are willing to tolerate me. So Dean's a little bit more...
Now, there's an endorsement.
Dean's a little bit more tolerable than I am, even. I would like to thank my very special guest, piano impresario, Dean Mermell. Can we say that? For coming in this week, if you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv.
I want one of those.
I want one, too. You can also, what I was going to say, anyway, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer, although he's not here right now. And our theme music that you're going to hear in a moment and you heard at the beginning was indeed written and performed by Dean Mermell. Not his reproducing piano. He actually did that. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA, although today we're in San Francisco. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week.